Sonali Kolhatkar and James Ingalls are two independent journalists and co-directors of the U.S.-based Afghans Women's Mission, a grassroots volunteer-run fundraising project that seeks to support the work of women's political organizations in Afghanistan. Both Kolhatkar and Ingalls traveled to Afghanistan in February of 2005 to witness firsthand the results of U.S. policy and to understand how ordinary Afghans felt about the war. Kolhatkar also hosts the daily alternative news program Uprising with KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. They have recently published a new book entitled Bleeding Afghanistan, Washington, Warlords, and the Propaganda of Silence, and will be visiting Halifax in the fall as part of their book tour. In the wake of ongoing large-scale civilian casualties in Kandahar province as a result of Canadian and U.S.-led military operations, as well as the recent deaths of Canadian forces and reservist personnel, both Kolhatkar and Ingalls focus upon the consistent failings of the U.S.-led Operation Enduring Freedom to deliver the security and development that has been promised to the country by Western leaders. This interview was produced in Halifax, Nova Scotia for CKDU Radio. In the last couple of days, the main international story that seems to have come out has been in regards to the British General Lieutenant David Richards' comments. He stated to the Guardian newspaper that the situation in Afghanistan was, quote, close to anarchy. Now that it's been close to 5 years since the initial incursion into Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, what's your take on the general security situation within the country?
I think the problem with Afghanistan that a lot of people aren't paying attention to is that the forces of the Taliban, the forces of the warlords, the U.S. forces, the Canadian forces, are fighting in a war that has many, many different elements. There's the element of narco-trafficking, which is a source of a big part of the insurgency. The Taliban are gaining in strength. They're seeing help from Al-Qaeda, and you have suicide bombs continuously. I mean, just a few days ago, there were more suicide bombs in Afghanistan. This is a phenomenon that is relatively new to Afghanistan since last December, in fact. Before last December, you didn't have suicide bombs in Afghanistan. And the United States and Canada are are trying to sort of fight a war when what they really should be doing is trying to keep the peace. They're hunting down Al-Qaeda members, but these are, a small group of elusive people, and it's not clear even what the criteria for success is. So instead of trying to build security and stability in Afghanistan, Western forces are trying to fight a war. It's a very misguided strategy, and the violence has increased. The situation has gotten much, much more volatile. And that's actually not a surprise to those of us who've been paying attention to Afghanistan. We've been predicting this all along. We've been pointing to the fact that if we don't pay attention to Afghanistan, it's going to get worse. It's going to fall into the hands of warlords and fundamentalists. That's exactly what's happening today. So, while others may be surprised at the specter of, quote-unquote anarchy coming to Afghanistan, many of us are not. We've literally watched the country unravel over the last 5 years.
Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs has essentially taken on the position that in order for there to be development projects, particularly within regions such as Kandahar province, there needs to be a sense of security which would only come with the rounding up of Taliban elements. Given your work with organizations like RAWA within Afghanistan, what's your response to the comments such as that?
Well, I mean, the rounding up of elements, it could go on forever. The real problems that the people of Afghanistan face are extreme grinding poverty, no jobs, they have no civil infrastructure, and they're basically turning to drugs to support themselves. A lot of the people in terms of farmers planting opium, planting poppies to support themselves, and the and they're turning politically to reactionary elements who are against the current government because they realize that the current government is not doing what the people need. So these are the things that I think need to be focused on. What needs to be focused on is providing an alternative to Taliban-type methods of governing, and not just an alternative to their style of governing, but to what they can actually offer the people. A lot of people are starting to feel like the Taliban actually might address their needs, their material needs, which the Karzai government and the U.S. and its coalition is not interested in, or at least Karzai might be interested, but it's not capable of doing, and the internationals are not interested in supporting the material needs of the Afghan people.
I wonder if you can expand a little bit upon that point, particularly within how this relates to the growth of opium as an industry within Afghanistan. What exactly does seem to attract people to the Taliban as a military force as opposed to the Karzai government?
Well, for one reason, one thing, the Taliban is actually allowing people to grow opium and support themselves in a way that they wouldn't be able to do if they were forced not to grow opium. In the current state of things, I mean, that's the best way for a lot of farmers to make a living. And so that's one of the things that people are sympathetic to the Taliban for. And another thing is the fact that the Taliban are against the foreigners and they're against Karzai, which at the moment Karzai is losing a lot of his support that he used to have. In the presidential elections of 2004, he had a huge amount of support. He won the elections by quite a large margin. About 70%, 75% of the population or the registered voters voted. But a year after that, in the parliamentary elections, the number of voters went down to about 50%. And in some provinces, was down to less than 30%. So, I mean, people are starting to think that the government is no longer working in their interests, and especially when the government is seen to be walking hand in hand with the United States, which is increasingly being seen as an aggressive force that is not doing any good for the people. So the Taliban are appearing more and more of a palatable option for a lot of people. I mean, essentially, the U.S. is another warlord, except this one is not. The U.S. is not providing anything for the people, so the Taliban might as well try the Taliban, or at least they're Afghan.
And well, just to add one thing to that, I think that the Western forces, both the U.S. and NATO in Afghanistan, could actually do a lot of constructive good if they were to approach the issue of opium growing with, you know, in a progressive manner. Afghans don't really want to grow opium. It's a shameful fact for them that their country is the source of the largest heroin production in the world. When we were visiting Afghanistan last year, several people told us that, but when they have zero choice, when it's a choice of, you know, choice between starving to death and growing a narcotic, then of course any of us, any human being would choose to try to survive. So if the U.S. and NATO were really interested in helping out the people of Afghanistan, in fact even, you know, keeping their own popularity up, they might try to work with the Afghan people to come up with proper alternatives, with viable alternatives to growing opium, a viable alternative economy, something that actually puts just as much money in the pockets of the Afghan people as opium might, but would actually be constructive. That's hard. That's not an easy thing to do, but, you know, it's something that must be done. And if the U.S. and NATO are not going to do it, naturally the people are going to grow opium. They're going to want to turn to the Taliban. A lot of farmers, are going to turn to opium as the only means to keep their family afloat.
A recent story that's been within the Canadian press has been the death of a 19-year-old reservist from Ontario named Anthony Boneka, who basically criticized greatly the Canadian presence within Afghanistan, stating that he had believed when he left for the country that he would be there on a peacekeeping mission. As well, the recent Senlis Council report has criticized the Harper government within Canada of giving the impression that the mission of ISAF and Operation Enduring Freedom was sort of part of a peacekeeping mission. From some of the reports that you've heard, how accurate are those claims?
Well, the Canadian troops are in charge of some what are called provincial reconstruction teams in the south of Afghanistan, which is an area that the Taliban have a lot of popularity and strength, had their original backing back in the 1990s. And these provincial reconstruction teams that the Canadian troops are involved in, their goal is very vague, but they were basically set up by the United States to provide public relations, essentially, for the U.S. effort, and to do small reconstruction projects here and there just to make troops look good. But by and large, they're essentially a wing of the U.S.'s Operation Enduring Freedom. Especially in areas, I mean, the area where Canada is now, the insurgency, the forces, Taliban groups and other insurgent groups are seeing these troops that come in, the foreign troops, and using them as a target. There's just no way that the troops are going to be there to do peacekeeping. They have to, they're basically, they've gotten themselves caught up in the United States' game, which is hunting down terrorists, so-called terrorists, breaking down the doors of Afghan homes. And they've essentially allowed themselves to work in the U.S.'s counter-terrorist-style mode, essentially a counterinsurgency approach.
I think that General Hiller's statements said it all. The Canadian Chief of Defense, when he said we are the Canadian forces and our job is to be able to kill people, I think it's pretty clear. And I think that essentially Canadians need to understand that ultimately they are going to have to operate under the umbrella of the United States and its approach to fighting the so-called war on terror. Canada, no matter what the Canadian people want, and no matter how noble they want their forces to be, no matter how noble a job they want their forces to do, such as reconstruction, helping democracy, etc., ultimately, because of the political dynamics between the U.S. and Canada, Canada is going to be functioning under the U.S. And the U.S. is the world's foremost imperialist country. In a way, Canada is going to function and already has been functioning as the junior partner of that imperialist country. That's true in Afghanistan, and I think that really needs to be understood in Canada, where I know it's, you know, it's definitely, there's been such a national dialogue on this issue of Canadian troops. I don't think Canadian troops are really going to be able to have any kind of independence, but, you know, if perhaps there is a sort of outpouring of demands from Canadians that they want their forces to actually do something constructive rather than destructive, you know, maybe something could change. And really, soldiers are needed, foreign troops are needed in Afghanistan, but to do the constructive things, to really help in keeping the peace in a country that's been racked by war, fueled by foreign forces for far too long.
Now, it appears over the next couple of months, the jurisdiction within Kandahar is likely to be turned over from an Operation Enduring Freedom mission, which is generally a U.S.-led coalition, to the NATO, a sort of NATO command structure. Is that likely to result in very much in the way of sort of constructive or reconstruction process within the region?
Not necessarily, no. It's not likely, but it certainly is possible. But right now, the NATO forces are essentially under a U.S. As far as I'm aware, the U.S. military is actually, they have a person who's basically at the top of the NATO chain of command in Afghanistan, at least on the military side. So that the NATO troop controlling operation is still under the U.S. Officially. And Canada needs to break with that, break with U.S. policy officially, ideally, officially, they should break with the policy, and then ideally they should go and put some actions to behind that break. First of all, they have to stop doing the search and destroy missions. They have to stop killing civilians, which is the main crime that the foreign troops are guilty of. They have to start supporting what the people of Afghanistan want in the regions where they're located. In terms of they should meet with the people who run the area, run the different towns and villages that they may be operating in. This is, I'm assuming that troops are there because, there's nothing we can do to stop them at the moment. And so if they have to be there, they should work with the people in the area where they are and start supporting people-centered programs, start supporting poverty eradication programs, stop persecuting poppy farmers, and stop working with the U.S.
I guess just in line with that, there's been a recent statement over the last month put out by a number of anti-war coalitions within Canada, as well as the Canadian Labour Congress and the Canadian Islamic Congress, calling for a National Day of Action to demand basically a troops out now, particularly under the auspices of a NATO mission. What's your response, I guess, to this particular call, which does also focus upon criticizing, I guess, a sort of slide of Canadian foreign policy towards that of the U.S.?
I think that's, it's a right of the Canadian people to not want their tax dollars and their troops in a situation where it's dangerous, it's not necessarily, something that's viable, they have to work under the U.S. It's definitely the right of the Canadian people to want to wash their hands off of it. However, from our perspective, as people who've been doing advocacy work for Afghans, on behalf of Afghan women who've been trying to draw attention to the immense suffering of the Afghan people, particularly women whose suffering has really been brought on by the interference of foreign countries. From our perspective, we wish that the Canadian people would demand that their troops stay in Afghanistan. And I know that, many listeners may be cringing right now to hear this, but stay in Afghanistan to really play a positive role. And the reason why we say this is because many surveys have shown, although this may be changing, that the Afghan people don't want foreign troops to leave right away. They don't like the presence of foreign troops. No, very few countries have people that actually like the presence of foreign troops. But they feel that the foreign troops are the only antidote to all-out chaos that the Afghan people have at their disposal right now, that the sheer presence of U.S., NATO, Canadian forces prevents warlords that have been backed by the U.S. for many years from just taking over the country like they did in the early 1990s. This is a scenario that the Afghan people have seen before, when after the Soviet withdrawal, U.S.-backed warlords literally took over the country, fought one another, killed tens of thousands of people, drove the country into such a terrible depth. Women were persecuted so badly. People were really, really terrorized in the early 1990s, and media coverage completely dropped. The world forgot about Afghanistan. And the Afghan people have, remember that. It's not that long ago. They don't want to be forgotten once more. They don't want the world to turn its eyes away. They don't like foreign troops, but they also understand that at this point, it's the responsibility of foreign troops who have been involved in creating the mess in Afghanistan to help clean up that mess so that they aren't left at the mercy of the fundamentalists.
But that doesn't mean clean up so-called terrorists.
Right.
it's a really difficult question. You have to think about it for every situation that your government is intending to put troops. You have to think about it in each case separately, as a separate case. You can't. I don't know if it's a good idea to have a universal past policy, but I think that the current U.S. and Canadian British military policy in Afghanistan is the wrong policy right now. That's not, but that doesn't say that the troops should leave. Ideally, the troops in Afghanistan should be troops from countries that have had nothing to do with Afghanistan in the past 30 years or so. They should be troops from countries that are, you know, not the U.S., not U.K., not Pakistan, not Saudi Arabia, and others. But we know that we probably can't get something like that to happen. But so we advocate a different approach. That the troops should be in there. They should be doing things that are centered around policies that are supporting the Afghan people, the infrastructure of Afghanistan, repaying the Afghan people for all the damage that has been done by proxy forces in the 1990s, forces that were supported in the 1980s and 90s by the United States and its allies, and the damage that has been done after in the wake of 9/11 and the U.S. bombing campaign, and that it continues to be done under the U.S. Current regime, or the current Operation Enduring Freedom. That's a damaging operation. That needs to change. It needs to stop, and the troops need to be there to provide security, to disarm warlords, and to enable the rebuilding of civilian infrastructure.
And another thing on top of that is the, you know, the issue of democracy. I mean, NATO and U.S. constantly talk about democracy building. Well, Afghanistan has an infrastructure right now for democracy, but that democracy is extremely corrupt because these warlords are in power. They're in the parliament. They should never have been allowed to run. And Afghan people, according to, you know, surveys that they respond to, want justice for these warlords. They want these warlords to pay for the crimes that they committed in the 80s and 90s. And it would be amazing if the West were to support an Afghan-led effort to have some sort of war crimes tribunal. The Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission showed in a very comprehensive survey a couple of years ago that the majority of Afghan people identify as victims of war crimes and would like to see justice for these war crimes. These were men who were created by the West. They need to be, you know, essentially deposed by the West, but, you know, in a process that's led by the Afghan people. And those are among the things, those are, you know, a variety of amazingly constructive actions that a foreign troop presence can actually take that will benefit the Afghan people.
I just wanted to also talk a little bit about the work that you support with the Afghan Women's Mission. From the website, it seems clear that most of your work is in support of the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. Just wonder if you could talk a little bit about their actions and, I guess, how they've evolved over the last 5 years and what international solidarity can really do to aid in their efforts.
Well, we recommend that ordinary people, ordinary Canadians, can actually, you know, take their own action by supporting groups like Rawa, who are doing that very, very hard work of rebuilding their country. Rawa is the oldest women's political organization in Afghanistan, founded in 1977. They're an extremely resilient organization that has seen war, fundamentalism, the rise of fundamentalism, you know, the rise of imperialist incursions into their country. And their approach to rebuilding their country is based on social services, healthcare, secular democracy, women's rights, human rights. They're a women's organization primarily, and they're women, you know, from Afghanistan who are either living in Afghanistan or in Pakistan. And they educate girls, they educate boys, they have orphanages, they have healthcare projects, they also have political projects, they have political publications, they do documentation of human rights abuses. They have a website where they put all that information out. They're an extremely, you know, remarkable organization of women that, in fact, I think we could learn a lot from their organizing methods in the West. And our approach here with the Afghan Women's Mission is to empower these women, to literally provide them with the funding that they need to do what they have to do. We never tell them what to do. We never tell them how to do it. we, you know, really go out of our way to allow, you know, have them make the decisions and have them, you know, decide what their priorities are and how to fund them, when to fund them. It's an approach that I think, you know, foreign non-governmental organizations should, you know, can really learn a lot from, because the Afghan people know better than anybody else how to rebuild their country, what's important and what's not, what's the right method to use and what's not. And so, you know, we have been working with them since 2000, since before it became trendy to think about Afghanistan, even before 9/11. And we've seen this organization, you know, go through, you know, just many, many changes. They take what they can get when the times are good, and they somehow survive when the times are bad. We had some good times after 9/11 because Americans and people around the world were compassionate. Afghanistan was in the news. They donated a lot of money. We were able to open a lot of projects. But now the media has gone away. The donations have plummeted. And unfortunately, Rawat had to close down a lot of their projects, which is very, very sad, because I think one of the most important ways, if you are worried about terrorism, if people are worried about terrorism, one of the most constructive ways that you can actually defy that trend is to support women-led efforts towards secular democracy and educating, providing an alternative for boys than the mother cells of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, providing a progressive educational alternative. And they can't do that. Rawat can't do that without the support of ordinary individuals. They do not accept government funding. They're an independent, you know, secular, non-sectarian organization. Their only ideology is based in human rights and dignity and secular democracy. So, you know, we're very proud to have been supporting Rawat since 2000. And we really hope that your listeners will take some time to look at their website and learn more about them. There's a lot to know about Rawat. There's been a couple of books written about Rawat as well. And you can find out all the information at rawa.org.
You've been listening to an interview with Sonali Kolhatkar and James Ingalls, authors of the recently published book Bleeding Afghanistan: Washington, Warlords, and the Propaganda of Silence. To find out more about their work with the Afghan Women's Mission, visit www.afghanwomensmission.org. This interview was produced in Halifax for CKDU Radio. My name is Stuart Neepy.